Blog Talk Radio. We left off in John Pomeroy's Equity Jurisprudence, Volume 2, in Section 879, starting at number 2 there, the purpose for which the representation is made under actual fraud. That's Section 879. That's page 730 in the PDF or page 1565 in the book. That's Volume 2, Section 879, where we left off. So take notice and acknowledgement with agreement that this show and or documents is a private confidential arrangement not to be construed or relied upon as being legal advice for an individual legal situation or employed for making a legal decision. You will not use any of this information for making a legal decision or performing a legal procedure, and is not a substitute for legal advice and or guidance by a licensed attorney. This private show and or documents are for academic and informational purposes only, to be used at your own risk without liability to Christian Walters. By accessing or reviewing this show or using the documents therein, you understand with agreement that, with all rights reserved, without prejudice, Christian Walters is not an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of Florida or any other state, and has not given legal advice or accepted fees for legal advice, provided no assistance, advising, or guidance of any kind for use by non-attorneys or pro se parties in preparation or use of herein referenced, and has no interest in any use referenced therein, and is not a party to this or any action arising from, and is only acting as an authorized capacity as liaisons to communications between the parties. By reading and or using this information, you acknowledge and agree you are not a client of Christian Walters. These documents and show recordings are incomplete and void without this notice agreement being attached herein by reference and a breach of this agreement. Upon breach of this agreement, the breaching party becomes liable for commercial damages of $200 million or more per stultification or impairment per Christian Walters' discretion. Thank you for your understanding. Now we move on to what this study of equity, its revival of the study of equity, is all about, and it's all about equity. And to get a good grasp of what equity is, we go to John Bouvier's book, Institutes of American Law of 1882, Volume 2, Section 3724, Paragraph 4. I love this quote. Law is nothing without equity, and equity is everything even without law. Those who perceive what is just and what is unjust only through the eyes of law never see it as well as those who behold it with the eyes of equity. Law may be looked upon in some manner as an assistance for those who have a weak perception of right and wrong. In the same way, the optical glasses are useful for those who are short-sighted or whose visual organs are deficient. Equity, in its true and genuine meaning, is the soul and spirit of the law. Positive law is construed, and rational law is made by it. John Bouvier, Institutes of American Law, 1882, Volume 2, Section 3724, Paragraph 4. So the law is nothing without equity. The law here being civil law or statutes and codes and common law. And equity is everything, even without law. There's never been a successful society that was formed without equity, but there have been successful societies formed just with equity, without law. So those who perceive what is just and what is unjust only with the eyes of the law never see as well as behold with the eyes of equity. That's really discernment through equity. You get the discernment through the equity eyes. Law may be looked upon in some manner as an assistance for those who have weak perception of right and wrong. There's that discernment again. In the same way, the optical glasses are useful for those who are short-sighted, whose visual organs are deficient. Equity, in its true and genuine meaning, is the soul and spirit of the law. Or really, it's the God-conscious mind. It's the mind of God, and that is equity. They're one and the same. They're synonymous. It's what's fair, just, and right. And everybody knows that because it's been written on your heart. Not the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were not written on your heart. It's equity was written on your heart. What's fair, just, and right. And everybody knows what's fair, just, and right. Unless you suppress it. Positive law is construed. Rational law is made by it. rational law or civil law, common law. Your common law, your civil law, your statutes and codes was made by equity. It was the creator of the so-called law in this context, how we define law. And again, it's the thing that has the priority. Anytime there's a conflict between law and equity, equity always wins. Why? Because it's the creator of the so-called law. And unless the actual statute and code, the common law or the law, civil law, whatever, unless it's reflecting equity, it's not a true righteous law. It's not a law at all. And therefore, equity will bypass, sidestep it, make a judgment, and correct it, make a correction on itself. So it doesn't matter how many people don't believe something. What really matters is whether what they believe is true or not. You know, we could all be living a lie, thinking it's truth, but in reality, it's all a lie, and we're all walking a lie walk. Just because we believe it doesn't make it right or righteous or equitable. Now let's go to a public versus private definition, which is what I see everybody's got a real major problem with. They're so lost in D.C. land and so brought up and brainwashed, they don't know what the private really is. So we need a definition of what private is. And private is any relation. Remember, the relation is the key, because that's the first thing a court determines. What kind of relation are we talking about here? The relation is the key. Private is any relation that you imply express, which is your intent as a special one. And the next question I'm going to ask is, when did you ever form anything that was special? Because everybody thinks that, oh, I'm sovereign, I'm king, and all I got to do is say that the sky is purple and the sky is purple. Well, just because you say it doesn't make it so. Same thing here. Just because I say it's private doesn't make it so. There has to be something done specially. And what is that special? Well, that's what NTT is all about, New Trust Technology. We're here to teach you how to create a special relationship that will withstand in courts and stand up in equity. And that's the only true private side. And everybody else is not doing that. They're just calling the sky purple, calling it private, but it's not. Next question is, when did you ever express your intent to form a relation that was a special one? The answer to that is never. So consequently, all your relations are then a public by default, because everything defaults to public today, which ties in with the doctrine of election. The thing that you have to choose from, two or more choices, the thing that you choose substitutes for all the rest or excludes all the rest. Check out Pomeroy, Section 461. Now we have a case, LGVA versus Belvale Farms, 2011. Courts of Special Appeals of Maryland, where the appellants referenced Austin Wickman Scott on the Law of Trust, Section 2.8, at the 50th, which states, it is to be noticed that an express trust may arise even though the parties in their own mind did not intend to create a trust. Which brings in trust law, say the restatement of the second, also out of a Gilbert's book on trust. No party in a trust needs to know a trust is being formed. That's what that says. Let me read it again. It is to be noticed an express trust may arise even though the parties in their own mind did not intend to create a trust. Continue on. It is the manifestation of intention that controls and not the actual intention. Now, the manifestation of intention, that's your actions, your deeds, written down in records. That's what a deed is. It's a writing of what you've done in the past, memorialized as a piece of paper, a deed. What are your deeds? Oh, I did such and such yesterday, and I wrote it down. That's my deed. And we think deeds are pieces of paper of ownership. No, it's a record of what you've done. you bought a piece of property or you sold a piece of property. This is a manifestation of intention, these actions, these deeds. You heard the old saying that your actions speak louder than words. Well, here's the thing. It's the manifestation of intention. That's your actions. That's what controls, and not the actual intention. And the actual intention is having the actual knowledge, which ties in with the first part we read. It is to be noticed that an expressed trust may arise even though the parties in their own mind did not intend to create a trust. In other words, they didn't have actual intention. They didn't actually know they were forming a trust. Because it's the manifestation of intention, the records, that controls. It is the manifestation that controls, manifestation of intention that controls, and not the actual intention, where that differs from the manifestation of intention. An expressed trust may be created even though the parties do not call it a trust, and even though they do not understand precisely what a trust is. You know, that brings up a kind of like an issue. How would you know you were forming a trust if you didn't precisely understand what a trust was? Back in the text, it said, it is sufficient if what they appear to have in mind is in its essentials what the courts mean when they speak of a trust. Actual intention versus manifestation of intention. The one that controls is the latter, manifestation of intention. Now we move on to the Adams Court, the origin of English equity, where it says that Adams wrote, where we may confidently assert that equity and common law originated in one and the same procedure, that during the first 200 years of their history, they were not distinguished from one another. In other words, they just didn't recognize that they were separate jurisdictions. They realized that later on. They were distinguished being separate about the 14th century. Continue on. And that we now distinguish between them during that period, we do it artificially by the application of tests impossible to contemporaries. It is well on to the 14th century before we get any clear distinction between equity and common law. They finally realized that equity created the common law, and they made it distinct and separate. The principles were actually equitable principles that creates law, so-called law. So what is the true law? Well, equity is grace. And if you live by equity, you're living by grace, and that's how you live, because by law, you die. The common law, the statutes and codes, is all the result of living an inequitable life. So we left off on 879, the purpose for which the representation is made under actual fraud. It is an essential requisite, both in equity and at law, that the representation, whatever be its form, must be made for the purpose and with the design of procuring the other party to act, of inducing him to enter into contract or engage in a transaction. It must therefore be, if necessary, of a necessity, preliminarily to the actual conclusion of the transaction, and in the great majority of instances it is made during and forms a part of a negotiation between the parties which terminates in the contract or other transaction. So there are, however, very important exceptions to this general statement. There are cases where the misrepresentations cannot be said to form a part of any negotiation or treaty between the parties. The false statements may be made with the design that they should be acted upon by someone, but without any design or knowledge of their being acted upon by any particular person. For example, it is now well said that prospectuses issued by promoters or directors of companies, reports or circulars, and similar publications addressed to all whom it may concern, may be fraudulent misrepresentations giving rise to any appropriate equitable or even legal relief. Such being the object of the representation, it must relate to and be directly connected with the very contract or other transaction in question, must deal with the subject matter or other material terms and not be confined to other and distinct relations, transactions, or matters in which the parties are concerned. In other words, it's got to be a nexus. Continue on. In the language of an eminent judge, a misrepresentation concerning any subject matter must be material in its nature. That is to say, one which, taken as true, would add substantially to the value or promise of that subject matter. Footnote 4D. Case sites that support that. D says, see also section 890 and 898. Next section, 880. Presumption of the design to induce action. In order that a statement may be a fraudulent misrepresentation, a party making it need not have any malignant feeling towards the other, nor any desire to injure, nor need he be acted by any corrupt or wicked motive. For equity looks at the relations of the statements towards the real facts and the results which will naturally flow from it, rather than at the mental condition, temper, and feelings of the person who makes it. Footnote 1. Case sites to support that. If, therefore, a representation made prior to a transaction directly relating to it is of a character that it would actually, naturally and reasonably induce or tend to induce any ordinary person to act upon it and enter into a contract or engage in the transaction, it is in fact followed by such an action on the part of the person, then it will be presumed that it was made for the purpose and with the design of inducing that person to do what he has done, and that is to enter into an agreement or engage in the transaction. The design will be inferred from the natural and necessary consequences. Footnote 2. Case sites to support that. It's not necessary that all the representations by which a party is induced to act should be untrue. The cases hold that where certain statements have been made, all in their nature capable, more or less, of leading the party to whom they address to adopt a particular line of conduct, and any one of them is untrue, the whole contract or other transaction is considered as having been obtained fraudulently. The court cannot discriminate among the different statements, nor say the untrue representation is not very one which induced the party to act. The foregoing general proposition, it is sufficient if the statement is of a character as would naturally induce any ordinary person to enter in a particular line of conduct, and actually followed by one such conduct, is the practical rule which the courts determine whether a misrepresentation possesses the particular element of fraud, the purpose or design now under consideration. Footnote 3. States that it must be observed that the two requisite elements of the fraudulent misrepresentations which have been examined, that the representation must be an affirmation of fact, and the design of inducing the other party to act, are recognized and adopted alike by courts of law and of equity. Decisions at law which therefore be properly cited to illustrate these two requisites in equity. Back into the text. Next section, 881. False prospectuses, reports, circulars, and the like. The nature of fraudulent misrepresentations, their requisite element of being designed and naturally operating to induce third persons to act, and their important features are so fully illustrated by the rules concerning the effect of prospectuses, circulars, reports, and other similar documents issued by the promoters, directors, or officers of a corporation, as established by very recent decisions, and a brief statement of these rules may be proper. I do not intend at present to consider the general subject of the relations subsisting between corporations or their directors or officers. On the one side, the stockholders, creditors, and or third persons dealing with them on the other, but simply to giving the conclusions that have been settled by the courts concerning the effect of the documents published by or in the name of the company, addressed to all whom they may concern, which have misled third persons and induced them to purchase shares of stock in corporation. These conclusions cannot be better expressed in the very language which has been used by eminent judges. Quote, those who issue prospectuses hold out to the public the great advantage of accrue to persons who will take shares in a proposed undertaking and inviting them to take shares on the faith of the representations therein contained are bound to state everything with a strict and scrupulous accuracy and not only to abstain from stating as fact that which is not so, but to omit no one fact within their knowledge and existence and which might have in any degree affect the nature or extent or quality of the privileges or advantages which the prospectus holds out as increments to take shares. Footnote 1. He cites to support that. Back in the text, while mere exaggerated views of the prospectus and advantages of the company contained in the prospectus, circulars, or reports are not to be fraudulent, still all statements should be fair, bona fide, and honest. Footnote 2. Sounds like equity right there. Case sites to support that. Quote, if it can be shown that the material representation which is not true is contained in the prospectus and any document forming the foundation of the contract between the company and the shareholder, and the shareholder comes within a reasonable time and under proper circumstances to be released from the contract, the courts are bound to relieve him from it. Contracts of this description between an individual and a company, so far as misrepresentation or suppression of the truth is concerned, are to be treated like contracts between any two individuals. Footnote 3. Case cite to support that. It is held, therefore, that a person who has been induced by misrepresentations of such documents to purchase shares of stock or to enter into a contract with the company for their purchase may, if he acts without delay upon learning the truth, obtain relief against the company either by being struck off from the list of stockholders and contributors to the proceeding instituted for its winding up and final settlement, or by means of an equitable suit brought against the company for the purpose of rescinding its purchase of shares and of recovering back money which he paid for them. He may even in a proper case obtain relief from the fraudulent directors personally by means of an equitable suit for an accounting and repayment of the money, or by means of an action at law for the recovery of damages on account of the deceit. Footnote 4A. Case sites to support that. Let's see. It says, in the following cases, relief was refused on the ground that the representations were not fraudulent, since they were either mere estimates of the value of a business, which was well known to be very hazardous, or even ambiguous, or with simply exaggerations. Case sites to support that. And another one says, misrepresentations must be proximate cause of the purchase of the shares. Bartlett's case 3. Support of that. Back into the text. Relief against the directors personally requires a much stronger case of fraud than relief against the company. The purchase of shares may be set aside and the purchaser relieved from his liability as a contributor without any knowledge of the untruth on the part of whose issued the document. Recovery from the directors personally requires knowledge of the untruth on their part, or else that the statement should be made under such circumstances and knowledge would be imputed to them. 5C. Case sites to support that. It is also settled that the stockholders must take the requisite proceedings to be relieved against the company at once upon its discovery of the truth, any unreasonable delay in the act. Any act on his part tending to show acquiescence will debar him from relief. 6D. Footnote 6. The decisions required promptness on his part, and one of the cases, delay of 3 months after learning the facts, was held fatal. Equity aids the vigilant. This Whitehout case, Mixer's case, when a person has thus been induced to purchase shares, he cannot rescind his purchase and be struck off from the list of contributors, nor maintain an action against the company for that purpose, nor to recover back the amount paid after the winding up of the company, nor even after the proceedings to wind up have been commenced. Since after the establishment of these proceedings by an order of the corporation is ended as a legal being. But this restriction does not seem to apply to suits brought to enforce the liability against the fraudulent directors personally. Back into the text. Next section, 882, number 3, untruth of the statement. The statement of the fact must be untrue or else there is no misrepresentation. The entire doctrine of the law and of equity concerning that species of fraud which consists in suggestio falsi is based upon the assumption that the representation is in fact untrue, and its very name itself shows. This is the promise of fact which is assumed in every case which discusses the nature of fraud and decides whether it does or does not exist in any particular instance. This requisite element needs, therefore, no examination, no citation of special authorities, and is not susceptible of any exception or limitation. Next section, 883. Number 4, the intention, knowledge, or belief of the party making the statement. Intention, knowledge, or belief of the party making the statement. This element, the mental state or condition of the party making the representation, is the most important and characteristic feature of fraud, both in equity and at law. It is, moreover, that constitute of fraud which there exists the principal difference or divergence between the theory which prevails in equity and that which forms a part of the law. It will aid us, therefore, in obtaining a more accurate notion of the equitable conception by comparison, to present a very brief summary of the doctrine on this subject which has been settled by courts of law. Next section, 884, the knowledge of fraudulent intention requisite at law. The court is Queen's Bench, at one time maintained in a series of decisions the following doctrines. When one party to a transaction, A, made a representation of facts that was really untrue, and the other party, B, relied upon the statement and was induced by it to do or omit something and thereby suffered some damage, such representation was fraudulent, and A was liable for his actual fraud, even though he had made the statement without any knowledge of its untruth. His liability was independent of his knowledge or ignorance of the actual falsity. This theory admitted the possibility of fraud at law where there was no moral delinquency. It denied that moral wrong was an essential element in the legal conception of fraud. The same view was for a time accepted and adopted by a considerable number of decisions in different American states. Footnote 1. Case sites to support that. These cases have, however, been overruled, and the theory itself has been abandoned in England and in generally, if not universally, throughout the states of our own country. It is now a settled doctrine of the law that where there can be no fraud, misrepresentation, or concealment without some moral delinquency, and there is no actual legal fraud which is not a moral fraud. This immoral element consists in the necessary guilty knowledge and consequent intent to deceive, sometimes designated by the technical term the scientia. The very essence of the legal conception is the fraudulent intention flowing from the guilty knowledge. No misrepresentation is fraudulent at law unless it is made with actual knowledge of its falsity, or under such circumstances that the law must necessarily impute such knowledge to the party at the time when he makes it. It is well settled that fraudulent misrepresentations may assume the three following forms or phases at law. Now, everybody claims fraud all the time. That's the first thing they want to blame. Oh, that's all fraudulent. But to make a true fraud, you'd have to prove that the person had the moral intent. And the way things are set up, so now everything's decompartmentalized. Nobody knows what the right hand is doing with the left hand. And to prove fraud, it's going to have to be a whole lot more work than what people think. So before anybody opens their mouth and claims fraud, you better have done your homework about 10 times better than you think you were ever going to have to do. And you wouldn't want it coming at you that way either. And what I hear right off the bat is no more than what Adam and Eve did when they sinned. They blame shifted. That's the first thing that they did, and that's the first thing that sinful humans do. When something comes into play, the first thing that you do is you blame someone else for your own lack of responsibility. That's the whole crux of the world today. That's what makes all of us practice iniquity. We are not practicing the first maxim in equity. He who comes into equity must be doing equity. When you blame shift, you're violating that first maxim right off the bat, because it's probably your fault, your responsibility. You should have been the gatekeeper watching and preventing it from even happening. You were the first cause of the secondary fault. Back into the text. Number one, a party making an untrue statement has at the time an actual positive knowledge of its falsity. He states what he absolutely knows to be untrue. This is the simplest, plainest, and most direct species of fraud. Now, just like what I said, things have been so deep compartmentalized, that person can actually swear on a Bible and say, I know nothing of this being fraud. And they're telling you the truth. They're just robots told to pick up A and put it in slot B. They're putting a rubber stamp on the fraud, and they don't really know it. But you've got to catch the one who's implementing. They're not implementing. They don't have any actual knowledge of what's going on. Who's the one who implemented it? Look at the bottom of the contract. See who signed it. This is the simplest, plainest, most direct species of fraud. Number two, a party making an untrue statement does not at the time have any belief that it is true. The making of an untrue statement of the truth, of which a party, of course, has no knowledge and which he does not even believe to be true, is tantamount to the making of it a statement which the party knows to be untrue. And three, finally, a party making an untrue statement having at the time no knowledge whatever on the subject and no reasonable grounds to believe it to be true is guilty of fraud, and his claiming that he believed it to be true cannot remove his fraudulent character. A definite statement of what the party does not know to be true, where he has no reasonable grounds for believing it to be true, will, if false, have the same legal effect as a statement of which the party positively knows to be untrue. In each of these three phases, there is a moral wrong and a very slight, if any, difference of the degrees of the culpability. In each, there is actual knowledge of the untruth, or else the law conclusively imputes knowledge to the party. Now, there'd have to be enough facts to support that, that the law would conclusively impute the knowledge to the party. And that's where most everybody falls down at, the facts to prove, to impute. Continue on in the text, and treats him as though actually possessing it. Now, let me go back over that again. It says, if any difference in the degree of culpability, in each there is actual knowledge of the untruth, or else the law conclusively imputes knowledge to the party and treats him as though actually possessing it. You're going to have the facts to back up or to prove the imputation of the knowledge. Next section, 885, knowledge or intention requisite in equity. There are undoubtedly some authorities which, taken literally, would make moral wrong a necessary ingredient of fraud in equity as well as at law, since there require a guilty knowledge of the untruth is as an essential element, footnote 1. So thus, in Adam's treatise, the sixth, The author, after stating that there are two classes of fraud, the first by means of willful misrepresentation, the second by procuring acts which done by persons under duress or incapacity, adds, quote, in order to constitute a fraud in the first class, there must be a representation, expressed or implied, false within the knowledge of the party making it, reasonably relied upon by the other party, unquote, etc. Back into the text. This view is, however, certainly incorrect. It is fully settled by the ableist courts, English and Americans, that it may be actual fraud, not merely constructive fraud, inequity without any features or incident of moral culpability, that the actual fraud consisting of misrepresentation is not necessarily immoral. A person making an untrue statement without knowing or believing it to be untrue or without any intent to deceive may be chargeable with actual fraud inequity. Footnote 2. This is in Trailing versus Baring. Quote said that Turner, L.J., said, I desire in the first place to absolve the defendants from all imputation of the intention of actual fraud, but that by no means disposes of the case, for there are many states of circumstances in which there is a technical fraud, in which transactions are fraudulent in the eyes of this court, or characterized by the designation of fraud, although there may be no moral fraud. The question actually here is whether this case does or does not fall within the range of those cases which this court holds a transaction to be fraudulent, although may not be morally so. Unquote. In Ship versus Coskill, Lord Romilly added, I fully adopted the distinction expressed by Lord Resdale between fraud properly so-called and what is called constructive fraud, where persons have really been guilty of no moral fraud, but by species of construction of equity, they are said to be guilty of fraud. And using the word constructive here, the Master of Rolls plainly does not refer to the main division of fraud called constructive, in contrast with the division called actual. He is speaking of those instances belonging to the general distinction actual, in which the fraud arises from the construction of equity in contradistinction to the fraud at law, which must always be immoral. A couple case sites follow also support that. So a person, back in the text, a person making an untrue statement, although without knowledge, knowing or believing it to be untrue and without any intent to deceive, may be chargeable with actual fraud in equity. Whatever would be fraudulent at law will be so in equity. Yes, because equity always follows the law, unless it's not a real law, because it's not reflecting equity. So whatever will be a fraudulent ad law will be so in equity, but the equitable doctrine goes further and includes instances of fraudulent misrepresentations which do not exist in law. There are, however, well-established limits to this equitable conception, which should be carefully observed. Every wrongful act, even by persons in positions of trust and confidence, which gives occasion for remedy, is not fraudulent. Breaches of their duty by persons in fiduciary relations, acts of agents in excess of their authority, and the like, are not, as such, instances of actual fraud, although they may be sometimes fall within the division of constructive fraud. Footnote 3. Case site to support that says, in the acts in excess of authority as the agent is not equitable fraud. Back into the text. I shall further illustrate this subject, enumerate and describe the different phases and forms of fraudulent misrepresentations recognized by equity. Some of them will be identical with those found in the law. Next section, 886. Forms of fraudulent misrepresentations in equity. Number one, where a party makes a statement which is untrue and has at the time an actual positive knowledge of the untruth and then necessarily results intent to deceive, dissentir ad law. This is the most direct and in some respects, the highest form of fraud. Footnote 1. This is in Patch versus Ward. Lord Carnes Wellis describes this form as follows. Quote, actual fraud, such that there is part of the persons chargeable with it, the malus amalus, amius, the mala mens, putting itself in motion and acting in order to take an undue advantage of some other person for the purpose of actually and knowingly defrauding him. A bunch of case sites to support that. Back into the text. Okay, wherever the facts of the statement are the acts of the very party making it, which are represented as having been done by him, if the statement is untrue, the knowledge of this untruth is necessarily and conclusively imputed to the party. In all cases involving such kind of misrepresentations, if knowledge of the untruth has been requisite element of the liability, such knowledge will be conclusively presumed. Footnote 2. Does this conclusion necessarily follows from the form of the representation and the nature of man's mind and memory? In Henderson versus Lacon, the suit was brought to hold the directors of the company personally liable for the false representations contained in the prospectus, which untruly stated that they had done certain acts. And in Page Wood, V.C., after holding that such a suit, it is necessary to fix upon the directors the scintier, as with the action for dissent, that it must have been guilty knowledge of the untruth of the statements, adds, quote, in this instance, it appears to me that the sentier and clearly fixed upon the directors, from the moment you find a representation concerning their own acts which is incorporated, or which is incorrect, and which they must be taken to have known to be incorrect, and to have knowingly stated, and thereby have misled the party complaining of their misrepresentation. See also Schiff versus Crossgill. A couple other cases. Back into the text. In suits involving misrepresentations of this form, the party charged with the fraud is examined as a witness in his own behalf. The better rule is that he cannot be asked as a part of his examination in chief whether or not he believes this misrepresentation to be true. Footnote 3. Hind versus Champion, to allow the party charged under the circumstance to testify in his own behalf that he had a belief or that he had no wrongful intent and the like is a violation, and it seems to me if the plainest and most fundamental principles of judicial evidence, if he asserts his belief and denies his intent and reliance is placed upon which he says, then his liability is destroyed and the controversy is ended. Back into the text. Number 2, if a person makes an untrue statement and has at the same time no knowledge of its truth and even has no belief in its truth, he is chargeable with fraud in equity as well as in law. Making a statement which the party does not believe to be true is only slightly removed in culpability from making a statement which the party knows to be false. Footnote 4, case sites to support that. They were asserting a known fact known to the party that was only opinion. Next section, 887, the same. Number 3, where a person makes an untrue statement and has at the time no knowledge of the truth and there are no reasonable grounds for his believing it to be true, he is chargeable with fraud, although he had no absolute knowledge of its untruth and may claim to have had belief in its truth. Footnote 1a. This is the mode in which the rule is ordinarily laid down by courts of law and sometimes by courts of equity. The equity cases, however, settled the rule in somewhat broader terms, omitting entirely the qualification that there are no reasonable grounds for the person believing his statement to be true. In other words, it is settled in equity by an overwhelming array of authority that where a person makes a statement of fact which is actually untrue, he has at the time no knowledge whatever of the matter, he is chargeable with fraud, and his claim to have believed in the truth of his statement cannot be regarded as at all material. The definite assertion of something which is untrue concerning which the party has no knowledge at all is tantamount as an effect to the assertion of something which a party knows to be untrue. Footnote 2b. It says in 2 that it might perhaps be said that the two modes of this stating the doctrine were virtually the same because of the party had no knowledge at all concerning the matter. He certainly would have no reasonable grounds for believing a statement to be true. It is plain, however, that the equity courts intend their language to be broader than that of the law courts and to include instances not falling within the legal formula. The qualifications, quote, there are no reasonable grounds for believing his statement, unquote, seems to imply circumstances would operate affirmatively to prevent the party from forming a belief. The language of the equity court in omitting its qualification seems to be wholly negative and the requisite and require only an absence of knowledge. A bunch of cases to support. In the last case, the court said, that would be Hart versus Swain, the defendant took upon himself to assert that the truth, which was turned out to be false, and made his assertion from the purpose of benefiting himself. Although he may have done it believing it to be true, the result is that he is found guilty of fraud. In Rawlings versus Whitcomb, Turner L.J. said, if upon a treaty for purpose of purchase of one of the parties to the contract make a representation materially affecting the subject matter of the contract, he surely cannot be heard to say that he knew nothing of the truth or falsehood of that which he represented, and still more surely he cannot be allowed to retain any benefit which he has derived from his representation he has made turns out to be untrue. It would be most dangerous to allow any doubt to be caused to be cast upon this doctrine. A bunch of case sites to support that. A lot of them. Back into the text. Next section is 888, the same, number 4. Where a person makes a statement of fact which is untrue, but at the time of making he honestly believes it to be true, and this belief is based upon reasonable grounds which actually exist, the misrepresentation so made is not fraudulent either in fraud or either in equity or at law. This general proposition is subject, however, to the two following important limitations. Number 5, where such an untrue statement is made in the honest belief of its truth, so that it is the result of an innocent error, and the truth is afterwards discovered by the person who has innocently made the incorrect representation, and if he then suffers the other party from continuing an error, and to act on the belief that no mistake has been made, this, from the time of the discovery, becomes inequity, a fraudulent misrepresentation, even though it was not so originally. 6, finally, if a statement of fact actually untrue is made by a person who honestly believes it to be true, but under such circumstances the duty of knowing the truth rests upon him, which, if fulfilled, would have prevented him from making the statement, such misrepresentation may be fraudulent inequity and a person answerable for fraud. Forgetfulness, ignorance, mistake cannot avail to overcome its pre-existing duty of knowing and telling the truth. Footnote 3c. Case sites to support that. Back in the text, next section, 889. Requisite of misrepresentations as a defense to the specific enforcement of contracts and equity. So having thus described the elements of misrepresentations with reference to the knowledge or belief of a person, in order that it may constitute fraud in the contemplation of equity, and having explained the various forms or phases which such a misrepresentation may assume, it may be proper to represent this connection with special features and qualities of a misrepresentation which apply to the particular cases of defense to suits for the enforcement of contracts. The entire view of this subject will thus be completed. In setting up a material misrepresentation to defeat the specific performance of a contract, the element of scientia, of knowledge, of belief with or without reasonable grounds or of intent is wholly unnecessary and immaterial. So So far as most essential elements of fraudulent misrepresentation is concerned, it is sufficient to defeat a specific performance that the statement is actually untrue so as to mislead the party to whom it is addressed. The party making it need not know of its falsity, nor have any intent to deceive, nor does his belief in its truth make any difference. With respect to its effect upon the specific performance of a contract, a party making a statement is as true, however, honestly, for the purpose of influencing the contract, or the conduct of the other party, is bound to know that it is true and must stand or fall by his representation. Number one, footnote one. Case sites to support that said that the following are recent cases which furnish examples of misrepresentations which have been set up to defeat a specific performance. Back into the text. The point upon which the defense turns is the fact of the other party having been misled by the representation calculated to mislead him, and not the existence of a design to thus mislead. It follows as a plain consequence of this general doctrine that if a party makes a misrepresentation, whether by another is induced to enter into an agreement, he cannot escape from its effects by alleging his forgetfulness at the time of the actual facts. Footnote 2. Case cites to support that says the same as untrue, the same is true in suits of for rescission and other relief based upon actual fraud. Back into the text, where the misrepresentation does not extend to the entire scope of the agreement or to any of the most important parts, but relates merely to some incidental, subordinate, or collateral feature of it, the court, instead of denying all the relief to the plaintiff, may direct a specific performance with an abatement of the price or other form of compensation to the defendant. Footnote 3D. See several of the cases in the last note but one. Back into the text. Of course, when the representation is so coupled with knowledge or want of belief or intent as to constitute actual fraud in any of the phases, it will a fortiori defeat the remedy for a specific performance. Next, section 890, number 5, effect of representation on the party to whom it was made, his reliance upon it. Another element of a fraudulent misrepresentation, without which there can be no remedy, legal or equitable, is, and it must be relied upon by the party to whom it is made, and must be an immediate cause of his conduct which alters his legal relations. Unless an untrue statement is believed and acted upon, it can occasion no legal injury. It is essential, therefore, that the party addressed should trust the representation and so thoroughly induced by it that, judging from the ordinary experience of mankind, in absence of what he would not, in any reasonable probability, have entered into a contract or other transaction. It is not necessary that the false representation should be the sole inducement. Others may concur that with the influence of the party. Whether several representations have been made, the one of them is false, the court has no means of determining, as well said by Lord Cransworth, that this very one did not turn the scale. Footnote 2. Case site to support that. An action for deceit, which the court said, although the inducements besides the representation have been operated in the giving credit, is enough if the vendor is moved by the representation, so that without them the goods would not have been parted with. Back into the text. The misrepresentation must, however, be concerning something really material. Statements, although false, respecting matters utterly trifling, which cannot affect the value or character of the subject matter, so that if the truth had been known, the party would not probably have altered his conduct, are not an occasion for the imposition of equity. Footnote 3D. Case sites to support that. See also section 879 and 898. Okay, section 891, a party must be justified in relying on the representation. I think we're going to stop there, pick up there next time. Section 891, that's on page 754, or that's in the PDF, and page 1589 in the book. We'll pick up again next time on section 891. All right, so let's go to Q&A. Press star 8 to raise your hand and get in the queue line. I will be back shortly. Okay, I'm back. Anybody have a question? Press star 8. Star 8 to raise your hand and get in the queue line. Star 8.
Hello, Christian.
Hello, who's this?
This is Ken from California.
Hi, Ken.
So you were discussing Pomeroy. I missed most of the beginning of the call. You were discussing continuing with Pomeroy this week, today?
Yes, uh-huh. Volume 2. We're still in Volume 2.
Okay.
Pomeroy.
I had a couple. I'm sorry?
Actual fraud.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'll catch up in my own reading. I had a couple of questions that aren't really related to what you've been reading, right? I don't know, directly. I'm curious as how, as always, my questions are about practical circumstances or potential problems that we can run into. But how can expressing a trust help us in a situation like dealing with the IRS or other government agencies?
Well, that would take us back to the NTT grand opening on November 9th of 2009. Any debt that is created has its counterpart, its equal and opposite. And anytime you merge the two together, they're extinguished or terminated.
Okay. So
NTT is really for the extinguishment of the debt.
So that's what we're talking about when we say we're dealing with the IRS. We're talking about some debt that we're told that we have that we need to take care of.
Yes, yes, by merger, which is under trust.
I see. So is there a specific example of a kind of trust relationship that we have with the IRS, or is it just in general a trust relationship?
Well, again, it comes back when we first started the NTT show on November 9th, 2009, and
okay,
the first, say, 3 months. And basically, that's all that is in the top 30 or 40 audios of today that we have.
Okay.
That's just basic NTT.
Basic NTT, that's just the beginning. So if I go over those calls, it'll really answer my own questions.
Yeah, the top 30 starting on November 9th, 2009 is... You know, the whole purpose was to extinguish the debt for the trust, under a private trust.
Okay.
And that can only be accomplished through a merger, and a merger only takes place in a private trust.
Wow. Okay, well, that really answers it. So all those details.
Now, here's another thing. In equity, where trust reside in equity versus the legal, where the contract lies.
Right.
The value stated or the debt stated under the contract is a limitation because it has a known value. It's limited.
Well,
on the other side, equity, the opposite is so. You have an unlimited asset ability.
Oh. Okay.
So you can never run out of something to extinguish the other side with.
Wow. Okay, I've been listening for a long time. That never occurred to me as a thought.
Yeah, the definition of an equitable asset.
Mm-hmm.
An equitable assets are all assets which are chargeable with the payment of debts or legacies in equity. So it has to be an equity. That's the only place that it takes place. Which do not... under the description of legal assets. So these are not legal assets, these are equitable assets.
Right.
So the portions of the property which the ordinary rules of law are exempt from debts, but which the testator has voluntarily charged as assets, or which, being non-existent at law, have been created in equity. Now that's Adams Equity, Section 254. They're called so because they can only be reached by the aid and instrumentality of a court of equity, and because their distribution is governed by a different rule from which governs the distribution of legal assets. Equity operates by a different system. That's Black's mm-hmm. Law Dictionary, revised fourth edition, definition okay. of equitable assets.
Okay, I'm going to make a note of that.
So you're taking an equitable asset that is going by a different rule set that legal looks at and applying it into the legal debt and extinguishing it. And that can only be done in equity under a private trust.
Uh-huh. And thus the need for NTT.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'll go back over the top 30 and listen
now,
to
Now, here's the big kicker. You find out that you've been operating in the wrong stage.
Yes.
The legal stage. Using the legal tools, dancing to the legal tune, and you've been in the wrong jurisdiction all that time.
Right.
You should be in the other stage, the equity stage, using the equity tools, using the equity music, and that's the only way you're going to get your substantive relief. We're trying to shove our substantive rights down these legal courts' throats, and they cannot recognize them nor give us what we ask for.
Right.
Only in equity. In equity, always a priority when there's any discrepancy between legal and equitable. Equity always wins.
Okay. So, I know you're reading from Pomeroy and all these older sort of masters of equity. So are these texts, pardon?
Yeah, these books that we're reading from are what the equity courts use as books of authority still today.
Oh, okay. That was my question. Okay. And that makes a lot of sense. And these are very important tools for study.
They're the foundational books of equity, yes.
Okay. Then that brings me to my next question, which is, I mean, your discussion now has been on the enforcement aspect and how to get into these courts. And my understanding is, in order to get that enforcement, we want to get into our appellate jurisdiction as the original, or the place of the original creation of whatever is going on. Right?
Yes, and past all the legal realm itself by filing directly in ourselves.
Okay. So what is the court structure in Florida? How does it work, and what do you define as the court where you need...
Well, basically, find worldwide, the court structure is all similar.
Right.
It's always the Supreme Court that is the head making up the rules from all the other forums down below it, all the other jurisdictions.
Okay.
So no matter what forum you're in, whether you're in appellate, whether you're in regular state court, or whether you're in county court or municipality court, those courts all, you know, the rules all come from the Supreme Court, the top court of the land, let's put it that way. Because in your state it might not be called the Supreme Court, but the top court of the land makes the
rules.
Top
court of land in the state. So in Florida, if you wanted to initiate an equity proceeding, you would take it to your Supreme Court as the court of original jurisdiction?
Well, we've kind of whittled it down that we have two options. It's either got to be the appellate court or it's the Supreme Court, say, in Florida.
Okay.
And that might be also in other states. But the reason why I say that is because even though the Constitution of Florida says that equity is supposed to be in the state court,
uh-huh.
it does not act that way.
Oh.
And it doesn't act that way because of a reason, I believe, and that's because it's been moved. It's been formed, I believe, in the formation of the appellate courts, and the appellate courts is where it looks to me that where it's at. Because all the different forums, the top court of the land, the appellate court, the state court, you know, they all have in their original jurisdiction, and that's what we're looking for, because original jurisdiction is where the enforcement of the writs are.
Right. Okay, and then that, and it's really using the writs as well to,
yes,
because
yes,
these are commands. It's,
the writs, yes. But the point I'm trying to make is that all those different levels or forums in the state here all have original jurisdiction to some degree, and the degree they make a distinct, they call it subject matter.
Right.
So the subject matter is the key part. You know,
okay,
breach of trust is a specific subject matter that one of the original jurisdictions can hear. And that is probably in the appellate court, not the Supreme Court, say. Because that original jurisdiction in Supreme Court, even though there's original jurisdiction in appellate court, the subject matters do not overlap. So you have to go by the subject matter you're trying to enforce in the correct forum or level of court, asking for the right thing, which is the show cause hearing on the writ. Writ of mandamus. And the writ of mandamus is for the enforcement of a breach of trust.
Right.
But you don't go in with a breach of trust equity bill. You go in with a writ of mandamus, because the writ of mandamus is the switch that puts it in the original jurisdiction. And then you have the correct subject matter in application to what you're trying to enforce, and you have to put it in the correct level or the correct forum that will hear that subject matter.
Oh, so we have to be clear on what forum can deal with that subject matter.
Correct.
And typically, once the Supreme Court has made a ruling, that's done. You can't appeal beyond the Supreme Court at over the state level issue.
There's no other court.
Okay. And so it looks like, at least in Florida, what you've discovered is that the appellate level, just below the Supreme Court, is where you have to go.
That's where the subject matter for the writ of mandamus and breach of trust is heard.
Ah, okay. So in California, I'm going to have to research that a bit.
Yes. Now, if we don't, say, win in appellate court for a breach of trust, it could be because we have a different kind of conflict now. We have a conflict as to we can't get equity where the Constitution says we have to have it. Now we can take the constitutional conflict, not for breach of trust, but for the fact that we can't get equity, and we can take that into the Supreme Court. And that subject matter will be heard at the Supreme Court.
Ah, I see. I see. That makes it really simple.
But what you want to do first is you want to come in for a breach of trust enforced by a writ of mandamus, and that would probably be in... I doubt whether or not the Supreme Court would hear that, especially if there was an appellate court created.
I see.
But that subject matter would probably be heard not in the Supreme Court, would be heard by the appellate court. And now we want to bypass all the hard work of getting taken into the lower legal courts, going through all the rigmarole, trying to defend it all. No, we're trying to bypass all that by filing in direct into the appellate court where the original jurisdiction is for the writ and the enforcement of the breach of the trust, and bypass all that time and effort and paperwork and take it in as an independent action.
Right. It's an independent action under that appellate jurisdiction.
Yes. Now, that brings up a question. You know, there is one particular person that might be trying to mislead people here because he's made a win.
Okay.
He wants to push his methodology, his win, but he's thinking about it for selfish motives because he wants to get the limelight. He wants to push his method. He wants to make money at it, and he's not looking for the good of the group as a whole, but for his own selfish motives. And he's telling everybody to ignore what I'm saying about the writs and the appellate courts. No, we want to simplify this for all.
Well, yeah, we don't want to follow
one guy because he says he's one. We want to make it simple for all.
Yes.
I don't do this for money.
Right.
Those that charge money, I would second look at them.
Right. And I do.
But when they say, ignore the writs, when I'm trying to tell everybody, check out the writs, they're going against me.
Yeah, it also doesn't make sense to offer that as an answer because then you're tied up in a technique, and techniques come to a dead end.
Correct. And why work twice as hard when you could have just gone into the appellate court, simplified everything, and just said, hey, you know, here's a writ of prohibition on the legal action going on down there. Let's put a stay on that. And let's hear the equitable matters upstairs, and when that's heard, then we go on.
Yeah, because the entire time I've listened to you, what I've tried to do is put my own personal issues to the side, the things that I'm trying to solve, and understand the principles that you've discovered that are important here. And as I get more understanding around the principle, the way to solve the problems I'm having becomes more evident. And I don't still feel well-versed in all the principles, but I understand where it's going to go. So I don't feel locked into a technique, and I think any specific technique is going to fail at some point.
Correct. Right.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
You know, I find that other countries around the world have similar systems as we do because they all came from equity, which was all English in its origin, but not really just solely England, because it came from the God-conscious mind, and that's been written on everybody's heart from the time one, from the beginning.
Right.
So it's the core. It's what's equitable. And every law, I believe, is formed on equitable notions.
Yeah.
So we have a commonality. I don't care whether you're in Canada or whether you're in Australia. We have such similarities with the United States or America here, you just can't see it.
Right.
And if you're blinded by your bias because you've made a win in your country and you want to follow your particular way that you've won, and I'm trying to tell you that this is a much more simpler way, now it comes down to whether or not you want to give up the method that you've done and follow me.
Right.
Because I'm telling you it's something else that's simpler.
Yeah.
But you don't want to leave it for number one because you're charging. You may be not charging an arm and a leg, but you may be charging. And you're relying on your livelihood from that. And if you're not doing your methodology, you ain't getting credit for it, even though you used an NTT process to win. But I'm trying to tell you there's something better out there, and that's through the writs in the upper courts.
Mm.
And you can bypass all that legal crap down there in the D.C. land by doing that.
Makes a lot more sense.
So, you people on the chat group, pay attention.
All right. I appreciate the answers, the discussion. That's really enlightening.
Well, did I answer your questions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I need to go for the first one. Yeah, I just need to go back and listen to the top 30 and really get a handle on all that. And that's about it for tonight.
Yeah, because it's really equitable rights are looked at different from legal rights. They have a different, like black and white.
Yeah.
Like oil and water. They don't mix. Legal
can't
be equitable, but equity can see both legal and equitable. Which jurisdiction do you want to be in? The legal, where you can't have your recognized your substantive rights?
Right.
Or do you want to be in equity where you got a fair share of both legal and equitable?
You want fair share. You want to be able to both.
Well, that's in the invoking of the equity jurisdiction, and that's why we're trying so hard to figure out how to open that door by the magic words, open sesame.
Right. And in the meantime, you have to do the precursors. You have to some relationship which establishes some equity situation.
The relation
is expressing trust.
The relation is a key. And although that the D.C. land or the illegal land looks at it as a contract, it's an equity. It looks at it differently and sees an executory contract, which is really two trusts.
Ah, interesting. Okay. That leads me to think that because people drop down in the at law all the time, it's always just a discussion of argument between trustees because the beneficiary can't be acknowledged in at law.
Yes. Yes, there's two trusts on a so-called D.C. land contract. That's just one half of the trust, the contract.
Mm.
But equity looks like an executory contract. It's for the purchase or the transfer of the money for the thing that you bought, and you're a trustee to do that duty.
Right, right.
And then on the other trust, on the other side in equity, is they have the performance giving you, say, the house.
Right.
So they're the trustee on that one. So they're the trustee on one side, you're the trustee on the other side. That's why there's always two trusts in this called half contract.
So you're only balancing the books on one side of an entire situation.
Correct, yes. Now, in NTT, we've added a rider to the trust on the equity side.
Right.
And that rider is for the extinguishment of the debt.
Right, of course.
So then that trust has not been executed yet because it's still got a performance duty left.
Right. Oh, it's so simple.
Yes.
At least for me. you've been trying to say this for years now.
Yeah, 4 years.
Okay, well, I think I'm on the same page with you at this point. Now I just have to get the same level of knowledge. Okay, thanks a lot, Christian.
All right. Thanks for coming on, Ken.
All right. Nice.
Okay, star 8, anybody for questions? Star 8, anybody raise their hand, get in the queue line, state your name, where you're from.
This is JB in Tampa, CW.
Hey, JB. Been a while since I heard from you.
Good to hear from you, too. I missed a call last week. I had a HOA meeting, believe it or not, but it went all night. It was a barn burner. But anyway, I've been reading along and following along like tonight as well. I got two completely different issues, theoretical as they may be. Let me address one because it kind of deals right along with what you've been reading at tonight here. I was looking at kind of pointing to Section 884. And I have to start with an analogy of something that's in at law, because this is where this started. I'm trying to figure out how to deal with it in equity. And reading along here, it's almost like I have to prove a negative, because in this situation I'm talking about, a plaintiff stands up and accuses a defendant after estoppel has been issued of a fraudulent conduct or misrepresentation of some kind that led to the estoppel, but never goes into any detail, just makes an assertion, never proves it. As you say, it's very difficult to prove fraud. You have to go through numerous steps, very specific, and come up with actual proof in your own hand, that this is what he knew, this is what I have, and shows what he knew, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's on the table. The court acts on that knowledge and reverses and voids estoppel. So how do you go back afterwards and prove they used fraud and the court relied on fraud without having them to prove the fraud? How do you use equity to undo that fraud down at the legal level?
Okay, I probably wouldn't go after the fraud methodology at all. I would be going after the conflict. Because there always is a conflict between legal today and equitable. they have opposite ways of looking at things. That's a conflict in itself. And if I didn't get that equity jurisdiction, I would be pleading the conflict because I didn't get the jurisdiction, because they're always in conflict. It would be the conflict that I would be going after and pleading. I think that would be much easier to prove than the fraud. And ultimately, the fraud comes back and rests with us because we're the first cause of it, although we didn't do it. But, you know, we end up causing all this because we're the ultimate government. We're the gatekeepers. And we've allowed this to happen, and now we want to punish them, but we should be punishing ourselves as well.
Well,
I think it's better to forgive and to forget, and let's just correct the problem.
Okay, so the if I can get this matter into an equity jurisdiction, you're recommending plead the conflict and variance between the headbutting is always taking place between the two
different sets of rules enforcing the two different jurisdictions, and they're in opposition, in effect, because the law is not reflecting equity. So I'm going to plead the conflict to get the variance, and the variance is equity. And I would have set that up in the lower case as objecting to the jurisdiction because I'm not getting equity here.
Yeah, okay.
The why I didn't get equity was because there's a conflict.
Well, what says, so you make that argument, you set it up, and you get the proper jurisdiction, then you're just going to rely on the chancellor to see through the fraud and the constant conflict and give you...
That would be a de novo do-over again, and he'd probably do it right there.
Be a de novo starting... De novo usually it means that they consider everything from the past as well, isn't it?
Yes, they might, but...
Oh, no, I got that opposite. De novo means they start from this point forward, but
it's all being new, and you got introducing new evidence that wasn't introduced in the old hearing or case.
Yeah, but what if you don't have any new evidence?
It's still a conflict. You
don't have any new evidence, you just got screwed, and here's proof of it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they judged on legal means, which are different in principle as to what equity would have looked at, which would have been opposite.
Yeah.
And that's my conflict. And I didn't get the equity jurisdiction when I objected, and I set the objection up in the old case.
Can you say that if I had been given equity, or if this matter had been given equity in the first place, that the estoppel never would have been overturned?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Let me chew on that a little bit, and I'll review this tomorrow when you post it too. Okay. I've got a separate item that deals obviously I think with maybe a big way we can all use NTT. I'm trying to figure out. I want to get your input to kind of get me pointed in the right direction, and that is a national act that's coming up, which is Obamacare. I don't want to participate, but yet we're going to be almost shackled to and penalized. What actions can we take to set up a trust with the appropriate agency, I guess, to put us in a position to where we can preclude ourselves from being incorporated in that monstrosity?
Withdrawal and redeposit, which is NTT.
So I have to wait for them to send me an invitation or some kind of mandate then, basically, like you would use it and make that the res, basically?
Is that what they intend to do, send you something?
Well,
opt-in?
I guess at some point, if you don't do what they want, they're going to send you here's a notice of your penalty because you didn't participate. And I guess you're saying perhaps wait until you get that kind of notice and then...
All right, where does that come about that they can do that?
Oh, I don't know, but that's I'm kind of looking ahead. That's what I'm thinking they're going to about penalizing you and fining if you don't participate. At some point in time, the paperwork's going to catch up to you.
How did they set up that authority that they can do that? That's by statute, right?
Correct. Yes. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Statute and do withdrawal and redeposit.
Okay, I can just use the current statute as it is right now. Don't have to wait for a penalty or anything like that to be used in.
Yeah, you can do that with all the statutes because all the statutes are a trust too.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I've been thinking more specific on the case level.
Yeah, don't get caught up on the leaves of the tree. Look at the whole tree as a trunk.
Yeah, this is a macro. This is a macro initiative rather than a micro initiative. Okay, I see what you're going to now. Okay.
It's like, what causes the whole problem? What's the quo warranto here? What's the authority they can do this by? Well, by statute. Okay, well, I just take all the statute and do withdraw and redeposit.
And then if they come after you later for enforcement, you're going to have to take them into the court to enforce your trust, basically.
Yes, right.
Yeah, okay. All right, we can do the withdraw and redeposit now, wait until we make sure we've got the final edition of the Affordability Care Act, or whatever they call it, and then maybe we can just redeposit that. Yeah. Okay.
Right. You seem to be a little more knowledgeable than I am on that. What is it we're looking at?
Well, everybody calls it Obamacare, but you're being mandated. You're going to have to pay for health care. You have to be enrolled in a health care, and they mandate what you pay for it, et cetera.
Well, that's just a way of getting your signature, so they can create more money.
Oh, I understand. I don't want to be any part of it. Don't want anything to do with it.
Well, I may look at it differently. Say, how much money do you want? I got unlimited funds. How much money do you need? But then turn around and create the funds and turn around and extinguish it.
Well, I haven't had any luck extinguishing anything yet, so I might just stay with the redeposit and try to avoid it. So.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, until I can figure out how to extinguish something, I'll have to deal with the macro initiative first, I guess. So.
Yeah, in equity, it's already done, you know, because it's forward-looking. Once you do it, it's considered complete. But, at law won't recognize it.
Right.
So there's where the court of equity comes in, you know, right? If you get in a court of equity, they got to recognize it's done because you did it.
Yeah, yeah. It'd just be a matter of getting into the circuit court here in Florida and
now,
getting...
Now, that right there is that conflict that I just told you about. The fact that law can't see equity. That's a conflict.
And they can't recognize my redeposit and the withdrawal and redeposit. They can't recognize it at all. So that is, in itself is a conflict and variance.
And that principle that equity looks at it differently and law looks at it differently, the law can't see equity, but equity can see law, that's a conflict, and that would be what I would take to the Supreme Court.
Okay, well, that's what I need to do on my... on my foreclosure case, because I've already been turned down by the DCA twice, and I filed two objections, and they just have stood mute, haven't done anything, and I think I'm about to the end of my second 10-day cycle, so I'm going to have to take that conflict to the Supreme Court, see if I can get any movement out of those guys. So that'll be the next step. I think that'll be a good foundation for it. So that's a good catch. Okay, I'll get ready for all of them, I guess.
That's like they don't give us any rest.
No, they don't. It's hard to find time to get caught up because you got too many irons in the fire, more marshmallows are burning, if you know what I mean. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for your time. That's my two big topics there. I'll keep you apprised as the situations mature a little bit. Thanks.
Well, don't give up. Get back up on the horse and keep riding.
Yeah, I'm going to get back and start riding again, or typing, as they say.
I appreciate your endeavors.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your time and appreciate you every week.
All right, thank you. So star 8, anybody questions? Star 8, anybody have a question? Star 8, raise your hand. State your name, where you're from. Who's next? Anybody? Star 8, anybody? Clear board, we got star 8, anybody? Anybody questions? Star 8? They have a question? Star 8? Gonna be a short night again, so star 8, anybody question? star 8 going once. Star 8, anybody question? Star 8, anybody? Going twice? Star 8, anybody? Last call, star 8. No questions? Okay. I'd like to thank you all for coming, and we'll see you next week. We'll pick up on section 891. And everybody have a great week. Before we say really good night, I'd like to say everybody, you know, to several weeks back I mentioned that to look for where the Constitution may have given the power to the legislature. And we've been coming through the judicial, looking for the judicial where they have, say, moved the courts of equity. And it also can be that they can move it legislatively. So you would be looking on statutes in your state where the courts have probably been set up statutorily wise, and be looking for some wording as to special proceedings, special term, and to watch the wording of how they kind of disguise it, where it says that the special proceeding is really governed by appellate. Now, they didn't say appellate rules, but that's what they mean, or Supreme Court. And that's how they would have set it up statutorily-wise instead of setting it up judicially, say, through the Supreme Court of the land and maybe moving it to a different forum or that jurisdiction we're looking for. And that would be a way of also looking at it, like, backwards and forwards to track it down and find out where it might be moved to. But it's the – when we first started NTT, it was looking for the – enforcement of the breach of the trust. And we found out it's not the breach of the trust pleading, it's the fact that you're going to put a writ in for the writ of mandamus. And it's the writ of mandamus that is the switch that invokes the original jurisdiction. So they've kind of hide the equitable breach of trust, but it's enforceable only through a writ of mandamus. And the writ of mandamus is the invoking of the original jurisdiction. So you want to be looking and tracking the writs of mandamus. And we're trying to bypass the lower legal courts from getting drug into the lower legal courts for the breach of the contract. And we want to do an enforcement for the breach of the trust under a writ, in an independent action that is put directly into, say, the appellate court or possibly the Supreme Court for the matter that can be heard under the original jurisdiction. Bypassing all the legal stuff and not even having to show up in court. It's all done by paperwork. That's much more simpler for everybody to do rather than go through the whole legal process involving maybe months or possibly years, tons of paperwork and defenses and things and everything, but to totally bypass all that by filing direct upstairs. Much more simpler. So that's what we're trying to point out. The writs invoking the jurisdiction, and that writ applied in the correct forum, and that forum that can hear the subject matter, and that subject matter being, say, the breach of the trust. So with that, I bid everybody adieu. Everybody have a great week. Night all.